Well, we've come to a milestone together, this community and I, after many years, dozens of talks. I just want to say I love this community, and I really wish you well. I wish you freedom. When the Buddha awoke under the Bodhi tree over 2,500 years ago, he said, "Done is what had to be done. All suffering has ceased." It's an amazing statement. All suffering has ceased forever. And that's my hope for us, for every one of us in this room. May each of us come to some place where we can say, "Done is what had to be done. All suffering has ceased." What happened to the Buddha was so powerful that we're sitting here this evening in November 2010 as a direct result of what happened to him under that tree in Bodh Gaya, India, over 2.5 millennia ago. We would not be here if that hadn't happened this evening. It's that powerful. And if you think for yourself, "You know what, that's not going to happen. All suffering is not going to cease from this heart. You know, that seems like so much hoo-ha." I would just like to say, I know it can happen for you. Whatever you believe about yourself, I think I can assert that I know that you can be free. And the reason that I can assert that is because I know that the essence of your being, the essence of what you are, is whole, undivided, perfect, and already free. That's our true nature. And it's just a question, we don't acquire anything in this practice. We simply uncover what's already there. And so if you feel that you can't be free, what you are is what you have always been and what you will always be, and you can't get rid of it. It's inalienable. So for all of us, it's possible. I believe it for myself, and I believe it for you, that it's just a question of stripping away the obstructions and revealing what is already there. And I believe that 100%. So may that happen for you. What we're doing in this this series of four gatherings, this is the last of four, is essentially what I wanted to do was really to describe the whole trajectory or the whole movement of our liberating path. And so I'd like to just review it tonight, since this is the last time we gather. It's just a kind of a general description, but I think it's really useful to see some of the characteristics of what happens to us when we free ourselves. It's just I'm just going to circle back for just a moment. Essentially what the Buddha said, if you don't like your discomfort, if you don't like the way you're in pain, if you don't like your anxiety, you know, if you don't like your being lost in grief or anger or hatred or fear, the Buddha said, if you don't like your suffering, then identify the causes and eliminate the causes. When you eliminate the causes, the effect falls away. Fortunately, those causes are identifiable, and I described them at the beginning of when I was offering instructions for meditation. The causes of suffering is we believe we're separate. We have to get past that belief. And we grasp for and cling to what we want, and we resist and push away what we don't want. Those are the causes of suffering. Those causes can be eliminated, and then you'll be able to say, with the Buddha, "Done is what had to be done. All suffering has ceased." So if I may, just to review, you know, what our practice is about You know, the Buddha described our practice very, very simply. He said, do three things. Do good, avoid doing harm, and purify your mind through meditation, purify your heart through meditation. That is, undertake the training of ethical conduct, of making an effort not to harm through your speech and your action. Forgiving yourself when you do, because we don't get it perfect. None of us do. We harm all the time. Forgiving yourself and then renewing the intention, actually to help and not to harm. That will bring more and more happiness to you and to others. So the first aspect of our training of the meditative path is really about our ethical conduct, which is what we do every day of our lives, every word, every action. And then the second aspect is this purification of our consciousness through meditation. And I've described a little bit, just in a general kind of way, what the process entails. And so the first task of a meditator is to tranquilize the mind, to have the mind, and you achieve that calm by becoming more concentrated, by having a mind that's more one-pointed, that isn't wandering off so much, that isn't lost in the cascade of thoughts and distractions. That as your mind becomes more and more one-pointed or stable, so when you're with the breath, for example, you stay with the breath longer and longer without being lost, as the mind becomes more one-pointed, it becomes more tranquil. And as the mind becomes more and more tranquil, and that quality of calm is a tremendous and beautiful form of happiness. And as we go deeper and deeper into that tranquility, into that one-pointedness or stability of mind, then we also experience joy, rapture, kind of delighted interest in our experience, a delighted response to our experience. And a mind that is inclined to rapture can be delighted with very small things, like the beauty of a flower. Or today, I was meditating with friends in Santa Fe this morning, and I looked out a window, and it was just simply the quality of the sunlight on some brown leaves of an aspen tree that hadn't fallen yet. It was so beautiful to me. It's that simple. It's that delighted response. And then as the mind becomes yet more tranquil, you know, through one-pointedness, through stability, then there's the experience of bliss, of this wonderful, calm, contented happiness. This is all possible for us. You just have to just get your mind concentrated, and you'll enjoy all of this. You know, there's a kind of cliche that meditators get blissed out. Well, we do. We will experience, as the mind becomes more purified, we experience greater happiness than we have ever known before. That joy of purity in all of its aspects. This is possible. So this is the ascent. The ascent into forms of happiness. But there's also, at a deeper place in the practice, there's a descent. And just as we need to ascend, that is, to experience happiness and joy, is necessary in order for us to awaken, by the same token, we have to experience descent, and we have to turn toward pain and to accommodate it, instead of our habitual way of turning away or resisting it. So it's like our capacity to experience gets wider and wider. We can experience more and more forms of joy and happiness, and we can accommodate more and more pain, because to be a human being is to experience pain, physical pain, emotional pain. It simply comes with the territory of being human. And as we go deeper and deeper into meditation, actually the forms of pain are not so much about our personal pain, although we deal with that too. You know, whatever unfinished business you have from earlier in your life that you've been avoiding, well, it'll come up. In the meditation, you'll have to deal with it. You'll bring it to, you'll have a more and more wholesome relationship to it, and that pain will diminish. You'll heal it. But there's a kind of transpersonal pain that comes, and essentially that pain comes from the fact that our understanding shifts, our understanding about reality shifts. What we believed to be true about ourselves and about the world, we discover is not true. And we come to understand, for example, we believe we're separate. And a lot of suffering comes, it's actually the most fundamental cause of our suffering is the belief that we're separate. If you do this practice long enough, you'll discover that's simply not true. We are not separate. So there's it's essentially our old understanding of the world, in a sense, has to be destroyed. It has to be deconstructed in order for a new understanding of reality, which is more accurate and true, to appear. And that sounds perfectly innocent, but it's a hard process. Nisargadatta, the great Advaita teacher, says, at one point he says, the search for the truth is the most dangerous undertaking because it destroys the world we know. And it's no fun to have your world destroyed. So there's pain involved, and there's sometimes very deep existential pain and real terror that can come up as part of the meditative path. Turning toward that pain, coming to accommodate it. And what happens as we go through the wonderful forms of happiness that can come with meditation, and we also deal with the kinds of pain that can come with meditation, is that we learn to relate more and more skillfully to pleasure and to pain. And it's our relationship to those two things that gets us in trouble and keeps us in trouble. Does that make sense? We come to be able to enjoy forms of happiness and pleasure, enjoy them thoroughly, but without grasping or clinging, so they pass when they pass. It's wonderful to have that calm and tranquility, you know, when the mind gets concentrated. It's just wonderful to have rapture, bliss. But guess what? They don't last. Where did my calm go? You sit down, you know, I want that calm that I had in the last sitting. You know, that's suffering. I want that bliss. Where's that bliss? So you actually come to, you allow things to arise, all the pleasant things to arise and then pass away without clinging to them. And with painful experience, there's a way in which you simply acknowledge painful experience is painful, period. And then you don't have to resist it. Pleasure plus grasping and clinging equals suffering. Pleasure without grasping and clinging does not involve suffering. Pain plus resistance equals suffering. Pain without resistance is not suffering. Suffering is optional. Pain is necessary. It just comes by being a human. Pain is necessary, but we actually have a choice about the suffering part. So in the midst of our lives of dealing with pleasure and pain, but also in the midst of the meditative process, we come to relate more and more skillfully to what is pleasant and to what is unpleasant. And then really, this transpersonal process, or this process of awakening, comes to a really deep fruition with the quality of equanimity, which is the non-reactive mind. And actually, equanimity, when it's very deeply established, is a greater happiness than anything else. It's very simple, it's very peaceful, it's not dramatic, but there's an amazing security in resting in a consciousness which is no longer reactive. When your mind is not reacting, you don't suffer. It's such a beautiful quality of consciousness. It gets more and more deeply established. You know, the image that I have of equanimity when it's really very deeply established in the mind and heart, it feels like the heart has become a mountain of diamond. It's brilliant, it's clear, and it's unbelievably stable. And then at some point, the mind awakens, what we call an enlightenment experience or illumination, opening to nirvana. We have all kinds of words for it. It's very difficult to explain kind of what that experience is like. But actually what we come to experience is what I was talking about. We come to experience what we actually are, which is whole, undivided, non-separate, radiant, and unharmable. That which we truly are cannot be harmed. It's not a state of consciousness. It's actually a state of being. And the best way I can describe it is it's a state of being which is very clear and spacious and peaceful. Maybe one way of describing it. There are many, many words for this experience, for this state of being. And it's usually the words, because it's so hard to describe, the words tend to be what it isn't. So it's called the deathless. It's also called the unborn, because this quality of being, which is what we are, has never been born and it cannot die. And it has no limitations. Can you see how the relationship to death might change when you have a sense of what dies and what doesn't? Yeah, this body's going to go. There's no doubt about that. But if you more and more you rest in what you truly are and you sense that that is not subject to harm or to death, I know these words may sound really woo-woo, but my suggestion is just follow the practice until you touch that. And then it's not as if that's kind of the end of the process. It's just, in a sense, it's just the beginning of the process. It's called stream entry. You're just entering the stream. And what the classic texts describe actually is you go through this whole process four times. And each time the mind opens, there's more purity, there's greater purity. Until with the fourth, then there's complete. That's when you say, done is what has to be done, all suffering is ceased. Then you essentially have the mind of a Buddha. So we have to go through this whole thing, the whole journey four times. But that isn't the end of it either. It doesn't have to be the end of it. So we wake up. We experience some freedom. There's less suffering. You know, eventually there's no suffering. I can't tell you about that because I haven't been there yet. But I have no doubt that it's going to happen to this heart. So you experience maybe even some considerable relief from suffering because now you know who you are. Now you know what your true being is. Now you know you're not separate. And when you know that you're not separate, then that reactivity of mind gets very much weakened. When you know you're not separate, then what is there to gratify with pleasure that you're grasping to? When you know that you're not separate, what is there to protect by pushing away what is unpleasant? You don't have to gratify anything. You don't have to protect anything because there's no separation. So you've experienced some freedom. Then what? You know, I think there are many, many people, many, many people, thousands of people over the years who quietly go off and just keep doing their practice until they're fully awake. But there are others, like the Buddha, who then, as it were, turn back toward the world and see how much suffering there is. Then it's like the veil's taken away from your eyes, and that which you were in denial about and that which you didn't want to know about, suddenly you can't help seeing and feeling. It's not just seeing, but really feeling. You can't help feeling the suffering of the world. And so it's possible then to turn back to the world, to open to its suffering, and to really want to help, and to help in the most fundamental way. So there's this moment of illumination. Then there can be this deep experience of compassion. You know that suffering is not necessary. You see that most people and most beings are locked in, are totally lost in suffering and don't know that it's optional. And so you try to help in any way you can to relieve the suffering. There's that compassion, and then there's service. And that's one way of describing this whole journey. It's not a linear thing. It's actually cyclical. You know, we purify our speech and our action through ethical conduct. We purify our minds through meditation. When they reach a certain level of maturity, they open, and we have a radically different understanding of reality. And our suffering is relieved, is no longer manifests in the same way anymore. And then we turn back, we feel compassion for the suffering all around us, and we do what we can to help. This cycle. So that's one way of describing the transpersonal path. And what I've suggested in these weeks for those of you who have come to these four talks. In the first week, I suggested that we open to every form of happiness that we can in the midst of our lives. So developing calm, you know, developing a concentrated mind, but also seeing goodness wherever you see it. And celebrating that goodness, celebrating the goodness in yourself, your own generosity and your kindness and your love and every act and thought that is helpful, to celebrate that and to celebrate it in others. And I suggested that we don't stay silent about it. I spend a lot of time acknowledging beautiful things in people, people I don't even know. It's just wonderful, you know, to... when somebody helps you in the hardware store to find the bolt that would have taken you 2 hours to find in the hardware store, you know, you say, thank you so much. You know, that was a beautiful thing that you were able to lead me to aisle 27, because I either would never have found this, or it would have taken me a couple of hours. Yeah, celebrating someone's goodness instead of seeing them as, you know, some machine that works in the hardware store. Relating to human beings and to other beings, to animals, as if they are our good friends. And it was one way of cultivating this happiness. And then I also suggested that we find a different relationship to pleasure, all forms of pleasure, to beautiful music and beautiful sights and beautiful smells and beautiful tastes and beautiful sensations and sex, and any kind of pleasure that we can experience in our lives, beautiful thoughts, and to see if it's possible to relate to them with rapture, with a kind of delight, rather than with grasping. You see, one is a liberating response, and the other is a response that gets us into suffering. You know, that can be cultivated. So I have lots more pleasure in my life, and a whole lot less attachment and suffering. The pleasure has actually increased, but the grasping toward what is pleasant has decreased. It's lovely. They didn't tell me this would happen. I'm enjoying it. I just love sitting on my porch and looking at the mountain. It brings me so much happiness, just sitting on my porch and looking at the mountain. And then in the second week, I suggested that we actually really pay attention to how we relate to painful experience, to see if it's possible to relate in a different way to physical pain. You know, is it possible to relate to emotional pain in a different way? You know, I think I mentioned, we're entering that season where things are cold. It's not exactly cold in here right now, but where it's cold, and we walk outside, and it's our habitual response when we get that blast of cold, is to go like this, to tighten our bodies against it. And guess what? When you tighten your muscles, you're actually going to experience cold more. And I suggested, you know, instead of resisting the cold, you just open to it and let it flow through you. You know, oh good, cold. It's unpleasant, but it's not a big deal. Do you see? It's only cold. So it's just by letting go of the resistance to an experience like stepping into the cold, you let go of the resistance, you let go of the suffering. It's really simple. And then in the third week, last week, we talked about equanimity, about the non-reactive mind and seeing if it's possible to cultivate equanimity. And we have had extraordinary sharing. In this month, in these 4 weeks, it's been extraordinary to hear about our experience. I so honor people who have shared in a deep way. A mother who nursed her son through his death with AIDS and then nursed her son's partner through his death with AIDS. And I responded to that sharing by saying it may be the most painful thing that a human being can experience to have the death of your child. I haven't been a parent, but I can see how that would be true. And then last week, somebody saying, my son was helicoptered into the hospital with cardiac arrest. And he's on life support, and it looks like his organs are going to come back. Do you see? I mean, this is not theoretical. And last week, somebody else shared with us that her favorite niece, 22 years old, married to a 23-year-old young man, working class people, in order to pay for their college education, he joined the army. And they assured him he wouldn't be sent to the Middle East. He was sent to Afghanistan. He stepped on an IED, an improvised explosive device, and a good part of his body was blown away. 20 surgeries in a month. Enormous, enormous damage. 23 years old. One leg lost. A lot of other functions lost. You know, how does the family respond to that? How does he respond to that? How does his 22-year-old wife respond to that? You know, this has been an extraordinary, and those are just a few examples. This has been an extraordinary month in terms of, we're not talking about Buddhism here, we're talking about our lives. It's not about Buddhism. It's not about meditation. You know, those are involved. The Buddha gave us some good teachings and a good practice, and it's useful to meditate, but actually it's about how are we going to respond to what happens to us so that we won't get caught in suffering. So, with all that, does anyone have anything to share from what has happened in the intervening week? Did anyone do the homework?
What was the homework?
The question was, what was the homework? And essentially, it can be any of those, what happened over those 3 weeks. It might be relating to happiness, all these forms of happiness, or relating to pain, or specifically, the specific thing that we talked about last week was equanimity. Is it possible to have a quality of non-reactivity when something challenging happens? When something really pleasant happens? I think I mentioned I used chocolate truffles from Trader Joe's as an example of a pleasant experience and how to relate to it. And I think I mentioned it here, and I also mentioned it in Santa Fe. Somebody brought me a whole box of chocolate truffles from Trader Joe's. Be careful what you talk about. So, anything to share? Anything? Please.
First, I'd like to thank you for these 4 weeks and your sharing of your heart with me. It's been a deep blessing. I also wanted to share a little bit more about the loss of my son and his partner from AIDS. And at that time and in that period, there were so many deaths of young people. And it wasn't just the death of my own son and his partner, but the death of so many young people that we were dealing with in New Mexico AIDS services who were dying at that time. And it's true that it was extremely painful. But the other day, I had some music on, and I started dancing with my son in the living room. And I was thinking about how much fun it was holding him as a baby, and loving him, and dancing with him, and now I'm still doing it in my heart. And there's something about Buddhism that has helped to bring me to a different level of peace. Those other things happen. They're in the past. It has to do with impermanence. And the fact that today I can still love and remember both of my children and be able to dance with them is indeed a blessing. Thank you.
Thanks so much for that sharing. You know, we talked about understanding the difference between grief, which we feel when we have a loss, the difference between grief and love, because love doesn't know anything about change and loss. Love doesn't know anything about death. You know, if you're connected, you're connected. So what you've just shared of dancing with your son or your sons, you know, it's very beautiful, because essentially it's the love that keeps that dance going. It's very beautiful. Thank you so much. Yeah. Anyone else who would like to share? Oh, come on. Be brave. I know there are a lot of people here. Oh, we have a hand back there, and then we'll come back to you, Victoria.
You go first.
Oh, were you going to speak? She's right back there. Please, if you would. Thank you.
When you were talking about celebrating people, not clenching, I was taking a Qigong class, and we do an exercise called Ichuan, and it's an exercise where you have to hold yourself into a position for minutes at a time with your arms raised in the air. It brings a lot of tension to the shoulders and the muscles, and instead of focusing on the pain that I was feeling myself, as I remember what you said about it just being just something, a consequence of what I was doing, and what I wasn't attaching myself to it. I was able to make it through the exercise, which was a very long time, without getting out. Also, I was walking home from Tai Chi that evening, and it was very cold outside, but I was again thinking of what you were saying. Just feeling the fresh air and the cold air against my skin, it was just really beautiful, and I felt very much a part of it, of everything that I was around. I could see the beautiful trees that were changing colors on the left and right side of the street I was walking down, and it felt really great against my skin, and the leaves were really beautiful colors, so it was really beautiful.
Thank you so much.
I'll just share. I have a pretty big voice. I just want to say thank you also, Eric, for being my friend and for being such a beautiful teacher. You know, one of the things that I've really gotten from Eric and from being in my Sangha is that meditation doesn't happen at my altar, but that it happens every minute. And I've really been practicing that and bringing my meditation just more and more and more into, oh, right now I'm pouring water into my teacup. You know, real little stuff, like Eric said. And taking walks lately and just really loving this weather has been so sublime, as we all know. We've gotten quite spoiled. It's been so warm and brisk and beautiful and clear. And my life went along, and then at 45, it all fell apart. The whole thing fell apart on the sidewalk, every aspect. And I almost lost everything and became homeless. But because I had people in my life that loved me, I didn't become homeless. I ended up beginning to be able to make a new life. And in this recovery for 5 years, I've had a pretty big diagnosis and a big recovery, and it's been this whole thing. And one of the things I'm realizing now in my life is that just in the last few weeks, I've been taking walks and having these brilliant experiences of it all goes away. And nothing has mattered at all about the collapse of my life, that I have a disability, that I live on a dime, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Like, none of it matters. And suddenly I'm in the day. And the leaves and the sky and the cranes and the sun. And all of that happened because of this practice. And my story doesn't mean anything anymore to me. And I love you because you taught me that.
Thank you. Thanks. Thanks so much. Anything from anyone else? Please. Yeah. Let's
can you get it across to her? Thank you.
I'm not sure if I can explain this correctly, but it has to do with accepting the suffering. It happened this morning in meditation. And I started meditation feeling very uncomfortable and discomfort, because yesterday was filled with uncompleted tasks and you know, upset with myself because the time wasn't productive, etc., etc. So I kept thinking, what is going on? And I kept hearing scolding voices. And it came to me that for so much of my growing up years, I was surrounded by scolding voices. And now I am the scolding voice. and how much pain came as a result of it, that was still going on. And I said, okay, stay with those scolding voices. And it wasn't so much what the voices were saying, but the feeling of being scolded that I stayed with. And it was very uncomfortable and very, it was like, stay with it, stay with it, stay with it, until it was okay. And I'm sure those voices will come again. But it was like, that's where the suffering was coming from. But I used to not want to pay attention to the scolding voices, but they were still there.
Yes.
And I finally recognized where the suffering was from. Mm. And just staying with the suffering was the answer. And I'm sure I'll hear them again tomorrow morning. You know, at least I know now I have a handle on it. And it's okay.
You don't know that they'll be there tomorrow morning. Maybe you sent them off to Vegas this morning. Yeah. Is there anyone else who would like to share? This is wonderful. Oh, a voice. Yes.
Very curable. But I am amazed at the sadness I have. And I don't know what I'm going to say, but I'm also amazed at all the joy it has given to me, the experience of realizing that life does have an end, and it really does. And I even called up my insurance company to see where I was on the chart as far as how long I would live otherwise, get an idea of how much I would have without the experience of breast cancer. But a change in that, I'm living more in the present, like sharing this with you, it's like now or never. That comes into my life a lot, of now or never. And so I'm being kinder to people, and I'm amazed at how much happiness I get from that. Kinder to Steve, my partner, and that's a wonderful experience, and what I get back. And just being more open with people and realizing they can choose. Like, I can be open to them and kind to them, and they can choose if they want to return something. And if they don't, I have no power over that. And maybe it will be something nice for them in the future or the now, but I have no power, but I did what I could do. And that is so, gives me so much happiness. So thank you.
Thank you. And if I may say, what you've just described is a classic definition of equanimity. We understand that we actually can bring about change in this mind and heart, but we don't have control over others. That is an amazing thing to understand. If once we come deeply to understand it, we can love others, we can support them, we can be compassionate, and we have no control whatsoever over their response. It's like that alone is profoundly freeing. So thank you. That's equanimity. Thanks so much. Anything else? Okay, we got a hand. Oh, please, Joe, and then Olivia.
I get into space, I get really spun out, particularly on politics.
You're the only one in the room. You're the only one in the room who gets spun out of politics.
So, you know, and it drives something that can really drive me crazy, and I get involved in this whole thing. I really like the comments about it, because on one hand, I think, you're getting too crazy on this stuff. Just chuck the whole deal. And just go, you know, totally to your own self and just forget all of that stuff. It's a lot more peace of mind. But on the other hand, I think, well, I am maybe a little useful to the world. I've written some articles and stuff, and politically, and, you know, maybe it's helped, even if it helps one person in the world or somebody from being killed. And that's my other train of thought. So, how do I keep from getting spun out? Thank you.
Yes, thanks so much. And if we can, is there a way? Olivia, can you really project your voice, or do you want us to bring? Oh, actually, someone's not going to hear you around here, so let's get the microphone to you. Thanks so much.
I just wanted to say something about what I've gotten from the practice. Well, I need to preface it by saying that it has to do with our being interconnected. And I came here because I've known Eric. And then this sangha made me feel so welcome. I'm a really shy person, so it's hard. It made me feel really, really welcome, so I kept coming and I did several retreats. And during that period of time, my mother was quite ill, and I was quite ill. And the Sangha was very supportive, not like one-on-one, but just knowing it was there was supportive. And the gifts that I received by attending retreats and doing the practice, at every retreat I would say, well, I'm a Buddhist Catholic. No one ever held that against me. And I'm still a Buddhist Catholic. But the gifts that I received from this practice are patience, kindness, and a kindness that permeates everything I do now. And so that's why I wanted to say something, because each of you, by being in the Sangha, has given me that gift. By coming and sharing and doing retreats and having retreats, you perform an unbelievable service. And I just want you to know that, because there are a lot of people like me out there who are Catholics looking for a way to train their mind. It's not something Catholics know how to do. So the gifts were kindness and understanding what love is in terms of compassion, and then the ability to live that way. Mm-hmm. And as a result of doing this practice, I have a motto, which is all I have to do is show up and be me, but I have to show up and be the authentic me. So thanks for giving me that.
Thank you. Thanks. Well, friends, thanks so much. I really love you. I feel very connected. May you be free. Actually, get free and save all beings. Thank you. And may the force be with you.